Doom Patrol, Negative Man, Elastigirl, Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action
is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Calder. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello and welcome to Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, where we talk about the Doom Patrol when it comes out and when it doesn't come out, which is in between when it comes out. So exciting times for all of us.
Yes, hello, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at AvonGarve. You can reach us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com or on the Waiting for Doom Facebook page. You can also check out related posts for each episode at mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com, done by our fellow Doom Bro Doug Zavisha. And all our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com.
And I'm Paul, and you can find me on Twitter at reading_Hicks. And we also have a Sentient Show Twitter account, which is Wilfred. And Wilfred is at WFDPod.
Hello, humans.
And we are sponsored by Comicosity.
Yes, that's right. The best comic book site for all the comic book love. And no surprise, my pick for their site this week is a review of issue 8 of Doom Patrol Volume 6, done by Matt Santorini Griffith. Apologies if I've mispronounced that. It's very early and I'm a little bit tired.
I think he just goes Matt Santori now.
Okay, sorry, Matt.
And today we are not alone. We are joined by Tamara Bonvillain, who is the colorist of Doom Patrol, the current run under Young Animal. And I'm just a little bit of an introduction for Tamara. She graduated from the Joe Kubert School in 2009, and she started colouring professionally around 2012, and then full-time by 2013. Isn't that been exciting? And she's worked for most of the major publishers, Marvel, DC, Image, Dark Horse, Boom, Valiant, Dynamite, IDW, etc. So welcome, Tamara.
Hi, how are we going?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us, Tamara.
Yeah, not a problem.
Yeah. So, Tamara, usually at the start of the show, we just talk about how our week has been and, you know, what sort of, you know, comics or movies or TV we've been into this week. What's been happening with you?
Well, mostly working, trying to get back on a good sleep schedule to my work. I just finished up the Ozark on Netflix last night.
Oh!
Yeah, I usually just put stuff on to, like, binge while I'm working. It keeps me, like, motivated to keep going.
Fantastic. Cool. And Mike, what about you?
I've been doing nothing fun other than work. and of course, I read issue 8 of Doom Patrol a couple of times now. And that's about the only comic people need to be reading at the moment, I have to say. Especially before they listen to this episode, because I dare say there's going to be lots of spoilers as we get into it.
Wow.
How about you, Paul? What have you been up to?
I finally got around to a bunch of Rebirth trades, so my friend Moby lent me a few of them, so I've been getting through them slowly. So I've read the first Flash one, and I've read the first Blue Beetle one, and Detective Comics, which was my favourite of the run so far. So.
Excellent choice, sir. Excellent choice.
Yeah. Good stuff. But anyway, maybe it's time that we... I don't think I've got anything for the going down on Derrigan Way this week.
Well, maybe Tamara can share some spoilers as to what might be coming up.
Spoilers? Not really. I don't really know the story too much sooner than anyone else. I'll get this script. Yeah, sorry.
That's cool.
I get this script maybe maybe a month or so before it comes out.
Uh-huh.
I get it as I work on it. I feel like that conversation is more between Nick and Gerard, you know?
Okay.
And I don't get it until I'm actually, like, coloring it. I don't, even if I get it, I don't read it until I'm working on it, so.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I'll forget. I feel like if I read it too soon, I'll just forget everything by the time I get to work on it. So, like, I like it, have it fresh and, like, look at the art and stuff as I'm working.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, we might talk about our little postcard drive that we've been having.
Mm-hmm.
So as you know, we've been inviting people to give us iTunes reviews so that people can find the show on iTunes, and it rises to the top of the massive pile of Doom Patrol podcasts, which I'm sure there is. And if you send us an iTunes review, we will be happy to send you a Doom Patrol postcard with, you know, Waiting for Doom, nice cartoon pictures of the characters from Volume 6, done by my daughter, but very cool, not just nepotism. Anyway, we have received two new iTunes reviews this week. So, first one is from Dr. Perky 17, but I happen to know this is Tim Price 17, because he told us in an email. He said, "For any fan of the Doom Patrol, this podcast covers all eras of the comic. Funny segments, entertaining hosts from Australia, dun dun dun, and well-timed sound bits. Mike and Paul are a joy to listen to, and they've been waiting for Doom Patrol. Don't make them wait for you. Oh Lord, so cheesy. Wait, Lord Cheesy, what issue was he in?" And that's a five-star review, and it's called "The Podcast You've Been Waiting For."
Thanks, Tim.
So, Tim's already got a postcard. So, we'd send him another one if he wants. We also got one from Fire and Water Rob, which has to be Rob Kelly. And he says, "Don't wait for Waiting for Doom," 5 stars. And he says, "This is a great, highly enjoyable podcast, even if you're not a big Doom Patrol fan like myself. The two hosts keep things lively and funny, and it's always entertaining. If you are a Doom Patrol fan, then this show is indispensable. Don't wait, make room for this show on your podcast listening schedule." So thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Tim. Very kind of you.
Awesome. So if you want to get in on that, we still have not received any Australian iTunes reviews.
Yeah, we're getting them from all around the world, just not here in Australia, which is a little bit odd, but oh well.
Something like a prophet has no honour in their own country or something.
Okay.
Get biblical. Anyway, is that ticking that we hear?
That is ticking we can hear, and it can only be the Doom Clock. So, looking at the face of the mighty Doom Clock, the last Doom Patrol book we had came out today, this week, issue 8 of Volume 6.
Right now.
Right now, which we will discuss in just a few short minutes. And I think I've got the numbers wrong here. I've listed issue 10, but it should be issue 9. Is scheduled for release on October 4th, just 4 weeks away. I think that's correct. We'll leave it in.
Yes.
It's fine. This week in Doom Patrol history, thanks to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, going on sale for $1.50 on September 3rd of 1991, with a cover date of October of that year, was issue 48 of Doom Patrol Volume 2 from Grant Morrison and Richard Case. This issue was titled "Entertaining Mr. Evans," and showed the team having to deal with the Sex Men as shadowy Mr. Evans unleashed all sorts of sexual chaos upon Happy Harbor. Meanwhile, in Venice, a certain painting had been recovered and Rebus got intimate with themselves on the very last page. We covered this and the preceding issue way back in episode 60 from June of 2016, so you can check that out for more. And that's it for the Doom Clock this week.
Ah. After a long day of criminal activity, there's nothing I like better than to sit down and listen to the old radio. Wait a minute, that's not a radio, it's...
Plastic Man! Plastic Man! Plastic Man!
That's right, it's the Plasticast, a brand new podcast dedicated to Plastic Man. I'm your host, Max Romero. Together, we'll be talking about Plastic Man in the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and every other age you can think of, right up to his upcoming reappearance in DC Rebirth. We'll also be talking about any Plastic Man news that might be coming up, and his appearances in every media from comics to cartoons. Whew. Makes me woozy just to think about it. I hope you'll join me to talk about the longest arm of the law here on the Plasticast, here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Plastic Man! Plastic Man!
And now it's time for Doom's Planning, and this week it's a new episode, a new issue of the Doom Patrol, yay! Woo-hoo! And so this is Volume 6, Issue 8, and it came out, it's written by Gerard Way, inked by Nick Darrington and penciled by Nick Darrington, coloured by Tamara Von Villain, yay, Tamara in the house, and edited by Jamie Rich, and it has a cover of Lotion the Cat, sort of in front of a brick wall,
just hanging out.
Catnip. Yeah. Wanting money for catnip. Looking very slacker.
Yeah.
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 So, Mike, take us through it.
But before I do, I just want to apologies for having to correct you, but the inks were by Tom Fowler on this issue.
Oh, crap.
It's all right. It's why we're a team. We look out for one another. It's not awkward at all. Anyway. Issue 8, Nothing Matters, Part 1 of NADA. So the issue opens with co-workers Charles and Edward discussing a problem with Mod 983. Not only is it still resistant to Intercon, but Vodcast is concerned about dormant fragments becoming agitated. Of course. They walk through a series of large cabinet drawers before opening one, revealing a body in a bag with several connected tubes. Edward scans the body with a small portable device, pleased that the extraction is going fast, before he farewells Charles and continues on his way. Meanwhile, in Dannyland, Keeg, aka the negative being, now joined with Larry Traynor, is somewhat successfully performing experiments to alter the biological makeup of the duplicate Dannyland inhabitants that the patrol rescued thanks to time travel when escaping the Vectra. Wow, that's a mouthful. Sorry, gang. And we saw that happen in issue 5 of this run, and which we covered in episode 89. Jane enters the lab, looking for Larry to join her for the scheduled team meeting, and she finds him fast asleep on a couch, although Keeg is adamant that Larry is unconsciously exploring the meaning of his existence. Back in the real world, Casey Brink, aka Space Case, is also heading to the team meeting, but is stunned to discover her missing cat, now Street punk Catman, Lotion, is sitting on the steps to her building. Casey lets Lotion into her apartment where she promises they'll hang out together after her team meeting. And that team meeting has begun in the Oculus Theatre room within Dannyland, where Keeg is giving a talk to the front row audience of Flex Mantallo, Hero of the Beach, Cliff Steele, Robot Man, Crazy Jane, and a still sleeping Larry Traynor. Ricardo, the super masseuse, and Fug, the cute little creature, operate a slide projector displaying diagnostic information about everyone's favourite Dambulance, at which point Keeg announces that Danny is injured and can't survive anymore on Joy alone, and that Danny needs to draw energy from Casey, who just at that moment turns up late for the meeting. Keeg tries to explain that after all the stress and horrible things Danny has been through, including giving birth to powerful beings that don't really exist, the best option would be for Casey to move into Dannyland permanently. However, Casey is offended by the notion that she doesn't exist, and after yelling at Keeg that she's real and actually does count, she begrudgingly agrees to relocate and storms off to spend one last night in her apartment. Elsewhere, at the Reynolds family home, Sam and Valerie are arguing over the fact that she wants to go somewhere to clear her head in order to deal with the fallout of being in Jane's cult, while Sam wants her to stay and work on rebuilding their family unit. They don't notice their son Lucius returning home until he overhears his mum saying that neither Sam nor Lucius could fill the void she once felt. So, like any angsty teen, Lucius retreats to his room and begins performing a ritual over the dead squirrel he picked up off the road on his way home. Frustrated when nothing happens, he opens a package that arrived for him, which turns out to be a new album titled The Magical World of Magic. Further frustrated and now confused by the album, he throws it behind him and continues the ritual, which causes the two bow-tie-wearing bunnies on the album cover to rise up out of the cover and stand behind him. Meanwhile, back over at Casey's apartment, she and Lotion are watching TV, eating noodles, and getting reacquainted. Just as she agrees to let him crash there semi-regularly, she notices something different about the way he looks. Lotion suddenly licks her nose, and then they share a kiss.
Like I feel, baby, come on, oh, come on.
Danny Land, Cliff is concerned about the amount of time that Larry is spending asleep, but Keeg tells him not to worry, as he believes he's learning a great deal on his excursions through unconsciousness. You don't learn by dreaming, replies Cliff. You learn by living. But back at Casey's apartment, she's awoken by her roommate, Terry Nunn, returning home. And Casey gets up and leaves her bed, where Lotion is still fast asleep. And, okay, Terry goes to explain that the cat has returned, but Terry excitedly interrupts her when her commercial for shit comes on the TV. A chorus line sings the virtues of the product and introduces spokesman Eddie Zilch, who tells the viewers that any food that shit is put on will become extra delicious and good for you. To prove that point, Terry offers Casey a sample, and after she has a brief psychedelic flip-out before collapsing on the floor, she soon remarks that it's the best thing she's ever tasted. But this bliss is suddenly interrupted by a crash outside, as Danny the ambulance is knocked on his side. The patrol climb out of Danny, ready to attack, to find two giant robotic beings with bizarre heads yelling, "Say I love you, fight us and say it." And that's such a bizarre, awesome issue.
I didn't really expect us to be doubling down on the weird in issue 8.
No. So Tamara, what were your thoughts on this issue as you were working on it?
It always gets kind of weird when you're working on it because, like I said, what I mentioned to you guys before the show, I'll read through the script, I'll look at the art. Sometimes the dialogue will change in the final, so, little details will change. But I'm staring at it for so long that it starts to almost lose meaning because you just look at it for so long, hours and hours on one page. But, yeah, it's always weird, but I kind of just come to expect that, It's pretty par for the course. Nothing too shocking to me, but, yeah, it's definitely, keeping the weirdness going.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
In the opening pages, am I the only one who thinks that the boxes on top of the cabinets look like comic long boxes?
You're not alone.
Yeah, that's
yeah. I was wondering what they were going to open the cabinets to reveal, and I'd love to know what those bodies are in there doing. It was such a bizarre opening, and all these words like intercon and vodcasts, and I'm like, what?
Yeah. And the two blokes, they really remind me of, the look of, comic lifers from, the 80s at DC. one of them particularly looks like Bob Wayne.
Okay, who's Bob Wayne?
Bob Wayne was DC's marketing director for forever.
Oh, right. Well, yeah, now I've just embarrassed myself.
I met him at a comic con in the early 90s. Out there with Dan Jurgens and Mike Carlin.
Listen to you rubbing shoulders with the hoi polloi.
Oh, yeah. You lived as long as I have. You've seen a lot of stuff.
Right.
So, the other thing that strikes me about this issue is, Keeg has gone from being, an energy being to a supporting character in the comic.
Yeah.
He gets more time than Larry does in this one.
Yeah, Larry has a really cool dream sequence where he goes on a little bit of an adventure. But, yeah, he's out for the entire issue, pretty much.
And, Casey seems completely unflappable no matter what happens. In the first issue when her flatmate blew up, she didn't bat an eyelid. And here her cat has returned in humanoid form and she doesn't really bat an eyelid.
Yeah, I have to say, Tamara, when the images of Lotion were first revealed, we had had all this speculation about who he was. We thought he might be Lucius merged with the actual cat. Of all the things that could have happened with Lotion, I never expected him to hook up with Casey. Never, ever.
Yeah, that wasn't exactly my first thought either, but things happen.
Oh, yeah. Look, when a cute animal, licks your nose, of course you want to reciprocate in some kind. And me, personally, not to that level, but, hey.
Keeps their own.
That awkward moment when pets become lovers.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, dear. All right. Tamara, do you want to start talking us through some of the colouring? I mean, what's your process for colouring an issue? How do you, you know, pick the tone and set the scenes for different environments and all that sort of stuff? Can you just take us through this issue bit by bit and give us a bit of an insight?
Yeah, just like generally speaking, I kind of start with like what is specified to me, because, you know, it's like a variety. Sometimes they have a more specific idea as far as color, what's needed for one scene versus another. So some, it may be like they're going for a very specific thing they tell me, and others, it's more on me. So like in this issue, like the opening scene was kind of like you wanted that beigey kind of just like you said, like an 80s, like kind of just kind of bland looking environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the stuff is already established, so I know how to approach that. Like the Danny Land stuff, the room is new and the theater is new, but so I kind of had that stuff just flipping through it too. So yeah, I kind of work like, I think on this one, I tackled the new stuff first that like hadn't appeared previously. So I believe I started with the lung room is what it's called, where they're doing the experiments in the giant like eye.
Okay.
So that was a new room. So I was like, how do I make this different from the previous things? And actually this one was specified. So it was like, it was supposed to be like a red room. So it's very red. Mm-hmm. And so to differentiate that from the other place. So it's like a dominating color. I have like kind of like green shadows going on. It's like this weird kind of like feel to it. The street scenes in front of Casey's apartment, that's stuff that's like appeared before. So I kind of like stuck to how that's been established. The theater was different. So I wanted it to look, you know, like distinct from other stuff in the issue. So I was like, well, how do I do that? It's like, you know, it was like dark in there. And so I kind of went like purpley blue kind of thing going there. The Lucius stuff was like a mixture. Like we'd seen his room and we'd seen inside the house before. So I kind of like stuck to that.
Mm-hmm.
Then like Casey's apartment. So Casey's apartment, when she's watching she's watching television with lotion, that could be like kind of similar to the theater. So I tried to like do it a little bit differently, maybe subtly, but just like it's more of like a purple and like blue kind of thing.
Yeah, getting the light source from the TV.
Yeah.
That's the only like thing in the room.
Make it feel a little different. The flashbacks, you know, to kind of like, or not really flashbacks, but his dream sequence, Larry's dream. Kind of like keying those different moments too, to like the first row of panels like red and then getting blue, green, kind of thing. Let's see, like the commercial was like a new thing. That was a little bit specified too, but we tweaked around on that. So just like the main thing I do is I try to like, I want every like scene to feel like distinct, you know, from one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It may not be completely new. There's going to be overlap. You know, there's only so many colors. But to, like, give something that if you look at it, you like, even if you're not thinking about it, you're like, well, I remember that from this. Or, like, it's, like, consistent to things that have appeared if it's the same, like, setting and time. And then, like, any new scene to, like, well, let's make that look different so that it's, like, distinct and, like, clear that it's a different time and place. And then there's panels, like, when she tries the shit, right? And then it just gets, like, kind of colors there, and just like something to kind of like, you know, just like emphasize the mood of what's happening to her there.
Something definitely happened.
Yeah,
she flipped out, man.
Right. So how long does it take to do a page or a whole issue?
It varies page to page. Some pages are pretty quick and some pages can take longer. It depends on like how many people are on the page, how complicated are the backgrounds. Is it like a new scene? Like if it's a new scene, then I have to figure out like the new palette for it, and it can take a little bit longer sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But even established stuff like the city streets may be a little bit longer, you know, to do the details of the street and stuff like that. So some pages can be like 2 hours. Some pages can be like 4 hours. 4 hours is long for that.
Yeah.
So I'd say closer to like 2 to 3 per page.
Wow. Gosh, and how many monthlies are you doing at the moment?
I think we're doing maybe 4 or 5. It's harder to remember. over the summer, I picked up a lot of, like, I was doing a lot of, like, one-shots or, like, two-issue fill-in things, so it, like, got kind of weird, the number. And some books don't, like, perfectly line up monthly, you know, like, some are on, like, 5 or 6 week schedules kind of thing, so. Mm-hmm. Somewhere like that. About, I'd say about five issues worth of monthlies.
Wow.
Gosh, that's a lot of time at the computer.
It is.
So, one of the things I've always been fascinated about with the coloring process is there's a whole flatting process, if I'm understanding mm-hmm. this correctly, which happens before the colors that we see in the final product are laid down. Do you do that yourself as well, Tamara?
No. Just for like time saving, most colorists, especially once you're like working full time coloring, maybe when you begin, you like flat a lot of your own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did as well. But yeah, no, at this point, I'll hire other people to flat for me. And basically what they do is they fill in, like, the flat colors. They separate all the shapes. Like, in Photoshop, there's a tool, like, the magic wand, which, if you select this color, it will only select that color. So it's all restrained within the lines, and you won't color outside the lines. Instead of having to, like, be, like, careful and not do it all the time, it makes it a lot easier. It right. sets, like, the base color for you to work on top of, which is, like, cool. And that, like, I was always slow at flatting. Flatting a page could take me as long or longer than the actual coloring and rendering of the page. So that's, like, a huge time saver. There's no way, like, most colorists would be able to work on as much as they do unless they hired people to flat the books for them. So, yeah, like, I'll get the artwork in, and then I have a couple people that I work with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll send those out to them based on their workload, too. And, you know, hopefully things time out. So you get artwork in time to send it to them and get it back. Because it's a huge time saver. Like, it's pretty much impossible to do this job without flatters at a certain level.
Wow.
Golly, yeah. I'm learning a lot. Where in the process does this fit with lettering? Has lettering already happened when you get pages? Or is that coming? Are there word balloons in place? Or?
Yeah, I think. If a book is running tight, right, like a lot of times a letter, like they can work over just a black and white liner. I'd say that's probably not ideal because you want to, like if there's color choices in the lettering sometimes, you probably want to see the final product to work, you know, so it works better with that. But sometimes things are tight that I'm working at the deadline, the letter is also working at the deadline, so they can't also wait for me, you know, to come in like the last minute a lot of times. Yeah. I think a lot of times they work over black and white, but not always. Sometimes they wait for the color finals.
Yeah. And this is, of course, is Todd Klein, who's such a veteran.
Yeah.
So, for instance, do you color Keeg's text boxes?
No. Like, anything that's in the actual lettering, that's all Todd. The one time that I did anything with lettering, now I didn't decide the colors, he still decided the colors, was when we did, which I don't remember which issue it was, 4 or 5, when she first finds out that she's, like, made up by Danny, she goes to the comic shop, and she has, like, the flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, like, the different, like, looks of, like an old comic booky kind of look.
Yep, yeah.
Because for that, I had to have the lettering to make that look actually, you know, or at least simulate that looks like an older comic or something.
Yep,
yeah. Like
and the Crisis on Infinite Earths riff. And
right. Like, he still set all the color for that. So, like, that was all decisions on his part. But, like, I used it to, like, integrate it with the artwork. So, you know, because if it's going to offset, it doesn't, like, offset and then there's, like, magic, like, modern lettering on top of it. You know, it would, like, have to be, it would have to all be, like, shifted and stuff like that to, like, together. So, but, yeah, no, all the color decisions on lettering. Unless, sometimes Nick will draw the special effects within the artwork,
mm-hmm.
then those all. But anything that's like added, that's all Todd.
Okay, so I'm curious to know, what was your first exposure to comics, and what was the trigger that made you decide that coloring comics is what you wanted to do?
It's like hard to say what first did. I probably just saw like random cartoons and stuff as a kid, and I just remember having like a vague interest in comics, and mm-hmm. I think like because I like kind of grew up in the 90s mostly, And like a lot of, you know, there's a lot of comic based cartoons at the time, like popular, like Spider-Man, X-Men, Batman were all on at that time.
Yeah.
So that, like, I was already interested in like comics, and that stuff like helped like kind of give me more information about it, you know, because I didn't have any money to go buy a bunch of comics. So it got me like interested in that more. And I was always interested in drawing and doing comics and stuff. And like I mentioned to you guys in the bio thing, that I went to the Hubert School, so it's like a very like comics focused kind of path there. And just, I'd always liked coloring. I'd worked as a flatterer myself for quite a while at a studio, not physically at a studio, but you know, like for a studio.
Yeah.
So like I kind of had some like a little bit of like a foot in that, and just like as I was going through the program at the school, you know, like drawing and coloring, but like I just kind of gravitated towards the coloring, and like other classmates would maybe like ask me to do stuff after we had graduated, and like, you know, you just kind of like build like a network that way. Like you're working with someone, and so like now you know the writer and the other people on the book, and that person maybe recommends you to a friend, or they bring you on another book, and it just starts to branch out because you work with more and more people. And just at a certain point, it just like started, took a few years to get rolling, you know, but, after a while, like I had enough of those connections that, you know, I started getting like bigger and better offers for doing stuff for like Image or like other publishers, like bigger publishers. And then like eventually like Marvel, and then like, I've been at Marvel since, and like then eventually doing the Doom Patrol.
Awesome.
So, I mean, particularly with the Doom Patrol, I mean, I think of the comic and I think of the colors. I think of, you know, the rainbows behind Danny in space, and I think of the explosions and, you know, dramatic tonal shifts whenever the action takes off in the issues. And, I mean, it's a spectacular comic, and, you know, I love having it. I get it on Comixology as soon as it comes out, which enables me to talk about it on the show mostly. But I'm also buying the, you know, buy the trades as they come out, and you know, just having the first trade, it's just a joy to look through. What's your favorite thing about working on this particular comic?
Yeah, no, like it's been really fun. Like I think that I clicked pretty well with Nick, like his art and my coloring, you know. It's like a lot of like I like cool like weird things, you know, like keep it interesting. It like there's nothing wrong with like more realistic or like subdued coloring, but like that's not as fun for me to work on. So it's like nice to just be like, I want to do like a weird like blue kind of palette for this. It's like cartoony enough that like you can just go wild and, you know, not you know, so literal with color and everything on it. So that's really fun. It's like I can't remember, like I think Nick maybe saw my stuff in like Moon Girl, which was like kind of in a similar vein. It's so, like getting to do that on this, just different like tonally, but still like kind of similar, and I get to do like these weird like, you know, just kind of like wild palettes. For a while I was kind of in a not that it's bad, I like enjoy that too, but like say like I work on a book called Wayward and some other stuff. I was in a very kind of like rendery kind of style for that, and it was like nice, like a breath of fresh air just to get to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would have been exact reverse too, like if I'd worked on all this stuff and then because I'm like, wait, where is it? Just getting to do something new and different was like fun, and there's always like weird like cool stuff in here that I'm not expecting either. Like I said, I get scripts like, you know, basically as I'm about to work on it, or that's when I read it, so it's like, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, discovering it at the same time and artwork and stuff. But yeah, it's been really fun.
So did you have any exposure to any of the previous Doom Patrol runs at all?
I was aware of them, and like I had like read, like I'd seen stuff that were like synopses of that and stuff like in the past. I have the first big, you know, like collection of the Morrison stuff, in Richard Case,
mm-hmm.
Which I've read a bit of. I haven't like read the whole thing after everything, but like I've kind of like have like a vague awareness, like obviously of like Morrison and just like general like kind of Vertigo kind of 90s stuff, you know. So I have a very like surface level like kind of awareness of it, but I've never like dove in completely and read all of it.
Okay.
So when you look at comics, do you find yourself looking at the colors more than most people would?
Probably. I mean, I think that was a thing that maybe kind of like spurred me on. I feel bad saying it, but like at a certain point, this is obviously not all comics, but there would be some books, and they were probably like not like, you know, like major books so much, but like I would see it and it's like color would not be very great, and be like, I don't know if I can color very well, but I know I can color better than that probably. but I don't know. Like I think I became like very aware of color more. I think the first time I noticed it was when Dave Stewart was coloring like those first Conan things at Dark Horse.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yes.
Like that's when I was first noticing that like he really brought like so much to that, which is not a, you know, anything against Kerry Nord who was drawing it. It's like it was, you know, meant to be that way, but it's just like he added so much. Like that was like, you know, he's adding so much texture and things to that weren't present in just the initial artwork. And I think that's where I like really was like, oh, this is like where I noticed it starting to be like more elevated, right? Like there was always good coloring, but that's just like where I was like, where like a name started to stick in my head as far as colors, you know? And then it became more interesting to me to be like, oh, I could do this, you know? Not to that level, but just, you know, that it's something that I could be interested in doing.
Yeah. Are there any other colorists who have become sort of heroes to you? Or?
Oh, yeah, there's tons that I love now. You know, there's the obvious ones like Jordy Belair and Matt Wilson, Dave Stewart still, you know. One I like, who I hear talked about less is, oh, my God, what's his... I'm going to forget his name. Frank Martin. Like, he does East of West.
Oh, okay.
I've seen him do, like, a lot of, like, several Marvel things before that that I just color on. There's so many. I'm going to feel bad because there's, like, so many people. yeah, I don't know. I don't want to go into the whole thing because I'll name enough people that leaving people off will be bad. There's tons of great colors. And like I said, they're always were good colors. It was just, for me, that was like the moment when I really like it clicked with me. That's also when I was getting more into comics again. Like it as an adult getting into comics where I'm actually like going to the store and buying comics and stuff. So I'm sure a lot of it has to do with that as well. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So have you had the chance to hang out with the Young Animal crew much in person?
Once. Well, last year there was a convention in North Carolina, in the States, and like a bunch of us, not everyone was there, but like Gerard was there, Nick Darrington was there, Jody Hauser writes Mother Panic, John Rivera, who does Cape Carson, was there, Marley was there, who does Shade, mm-hmm. The artist on Shade. Richard Case was there, who had worked on Doom Patrol in the 90s. I think that's it. I hope I'm not forgetting anybody that was there. I know Kelly Fitzpatrick already. She colors Shade. Like, we've known each other for a while, so I've seen her a bunch. But yeah, that was the first time as far as like the Young Animal people. I'd met Gerard briefly before that, but that was the first time we were all kind of like, you know, in one spot.
Nice.
Good camaraderie and shop talk.
Oh yeah, no, it was fun. Like getting to see everyone in person, like getting to meet Nick and talk to Gerard a little bit more. Like I said, I'd seen him before, but it was like a pretty short like meeting. I wasn't even sure it was him. Like my friend like brought him over to my table at a convention earlier that year. And I was like, I think that's Gerard Way, but it's like they were acting like so unassuming and no one like introduced each other. So I was like, okay, I don't know. This could be a random person or this could be Gerard Way. I don't know.
Getting back to the issue itself, I feel like we're being trolled by Gerard with all the hints at Mr. Nobody, because we've got Terry Nunn, we've got the title of this comic, which was Nothing Matters, Part 1 of Nada, and then you've got the salesman
for Eddie Zilch.
Eddie Zilch. It's like everything except Mr. Nobody being said explicitly here.
I tell you what, if it gets to the big reveal of, you know, who's behind, you know, shit, and it's not Mr. Nobody, I'm going to be a little bit annoyed.
But we know you can't tell us, so.
Yeah.
The good thing is, I don't know anyway, so I can't spill any
secrets. Darn it.
Give me plausible deniability, so.
But I think one of my favourite things in this issue is the plastic sheeting over the hole in the wall that says, "Danger, giant hole." That really delighted me.
Yeah, I love little touches like that throughout the book, you know, the plastic sheet like that. And I think it was in the previous issue where Danny, the ambulance, is out the front of the building and he has, you know, nothing to see here on his side. It's just such a great looking book.
Oh, that's what I wanted to ask you. Often in the daytime scenes, you basically have to set the time of day through the sky and things like that. Do you know what time of day it is from the script, or are you extrapolating that or guessing it as you go?
It's a little bit of both. It's usually specified. There was a couple of times in here where I did like discuss with him. Sometimes writers forget that little detail. You know, a little detail of what time of day it is. But at the end, when she's watching, not when she's watching television, but when she wakes up with lotion, right?
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure, because, like, is it still night? Is it morning? Or, like, what, you know, like, because it could be the next day. They were, like, in bed. Weren't exactly sleeping, probably, but, you know, you don't know. It's an implied passage of time there.
With the curtains shut.
Yeah. Like, at first I was like, well, it's not specified, so it's like, is this morning? We can do that to show progression of time. But then I was thinking, I was like, wait, well, like, at the beginning, or closer to the beginning, when she first meets Lotion, I was like, well, that was morning. And I just thought, like, well, it's probably more interesting that that's night, actually, so that, like, that looks different than, like, earlier in the book, which I think he intended to be night anyway. I wasn't 100% sure, and like, so I kind of asked him and went back and forth on that a little bit. But yeah, it's definitely something I think about, you know. So it's like another thing where it's like, yeah, from that moment it would show progression of time, but like, it was, for me, I thought it was better to show it like from the beginning of the issue to the end of the issue, instead of like kind of looping back around to being morning again. It just like seemed clearer to have that like be nighttime, you know.
Gosh, well, there's a lot to think about in the colouring that I'd never thought about. How do you feel that colourists are treated in the industry? Do you think you get your due? Are you recognised enough? I mean, certainly it's such a major part of the way the comic comes across to people. But, like, for instance, I notice the advance solicits from DC, they don't say who the colourist is. It's, you know, getting information about this issue, you know, it was very rare that your name was mentioned in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mix, right? Like, I feel like the people I work with generally are, like, generous with credit and you know, like, including me and other colorists, you know, especially on the Young Animal stuff, other books I work with generally. But as far as, like, solicit information, things like that, I'm just looking at it as, like, a personal thing. I still think it's dumb, but it's like with a company, right? It's like, this is just the way things have always been done kind of mentality, and they don't, to get them to change anything, it's like nearly impossible. But things change slowly, you know, like, luckily people were kind of making noise about that, like, before I came in the industry, then it's gotten a lot better, you know, like, people like Jordy and stuff, like, talking about cover credit. So at least we get cover credit usually now. Weirdly, sometimes you'll get cover credit, but a trade will come out for the exact same book, and your name mysteriously disappears in that trade for some reason on the cover. You get credited, of course, in the book. But like, the solicit information I've never understood, other than I understand that it's a, like, you know, people don't change kind of thing, but it still seems silly. Like, why is this hard to change? I don't understand. Even, like, in Comixology, I think they were trying to update it. I don't know where that is right now, but I'm listed for maybe like a handful of books I've actually worked on. Trying to find like books that colors have worked on by name, you probably come up with very few books on there. So that stuff, I'd say it's more along the lines of that. Obviously, you know, there's like definitely a hierarchy in who people generally care about on a book, writer being at the very top. You go down quite a ways, you've got the artist, and then go down even further, and that's everybody else that works on the book. So like colorists, letters, editors, whoever, you know, whatever role it is. Inkers, if there's even an inker on the book. Generally, I'd say nowadays it seems to be the artist inks and pencils the book. We've got Tom Fowler on it now, but you know, we say on a lot of books. So I don't know. It's okay. It's like, you know, what can you do? You try to like make incremental, you know, progress there, and get people to care about the stuff, and try to do what little you can to show. Like a lot of times, I'll show like kind of before and after or process stuff of things I'm working on, just to show like, well, this is where it began, and this is what I did to it. You know, and like you can see what I brought to it. And you know, that the people seem to react to that pretty well, but you know, there's only so much you can do as one person, so it gets better, so it's okay. You know, I feel like a lot of people do, you know, I get enough people, you know, seem to enjoy what I do, and that's fine. You know, it's okay.
Well, you've definitely got two fans here, that's for sure.
Definitely. One last comment about the issue, I guess. We get a fly appearance in the carcass of the squirrel. I feel like I need to form some sort of convoluted fly theory for the comic, but I haven't quite got there in my head yet.
I'm sure it'll all come together at some stage, because there's stuff from the first story arc that we still have questions about. You know, like Cliff fighting those robed figures in the desert. And then when he went into that bunker and hit that button and blew everyone to hell. Like, more info, please.
Gerard definitely likes to, like, plant little pieces of stuff for later.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, let's hope it gets talked about later and not just forgotten.
Yeah. I'd say most of that stuff, I'm sure, is probably there for a reason. I'm sure we'll get back to it.
Yeah. But yeah, it's good to see another, as weird as it sounds to say, it's good to see another little fly in there, you know.
You want to forget the flies.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we might wrap up Doomsplaining there, but Tamara, if you'd like to hang around with us for the Mailbag of Doom to follow.
Sure.
So yes, it's time for the Mailbag of Doom. And this week, we are reading your responses to the question, what is your favorite comic character costume color combo? And big shout out to Paul for all that alliteration there. But first off, we heard from Ange at DrAnge70 on Twitter, and he said, my first thought was the Creeper, loads of yellow and red with a splash of green, but I think my final answer is Sensor Girl from the Legion. The red and white with black accents just works. The yellow belt and inside of the cape accents too. Nice choices.
And Sensor Girl with the mask on the face with the bit like a red down the sides, then black, and then white in the middle. It's sort of a variation on the sort of Deathstroke colour combo.
Oh, yeah.
We heard from Clinton Robson at Coffee and Comics Blogs. He said, why can't it be all the colours? And then he put up pictures of Crazy Quilt, a DC villain.
I love that answer.
Just colour vomit.
Keith G. Baker at KG Bunsey said the original Green Lantern, Alan Scott. The purple shouldn't work, but somehow it does. Yeah, that's a nice scheme there. Yeah.
Green and red. We heard from Ostrakos 1, Ace Milk Tit Whenever on Twitter. It's our friend Kevin. And he said, the Silver Age Flash costume is my gold standard for design. The red and yellow, just a bit of white. Infantino did a spectacular job.
A good one.
That is one that you never forget.
Yeah. Alan Middleton at Professor Allen chimed in with Royal Green plus Polished Metal equals Doctor Doom. Yep. Simple but effective.
Oh, he's just biased. He just wants to say Doctor Doom. That's. we heard from The Only Living Boy. Is that, I think it's David Gallagher's comic. And he didn't name a character, but I can think of one. He said green and purple.
Green and purple.
Green and purple. The Hulk?
Beast Boy, maybe?
Doesn't the Hulk usually have green shorts?
Yeah.
No, he has purple shorts.
Purple shorts.
Yeah, that's right. He has green shorts and he's purple.
Unless he's naked and then he's green all over.
God. Moving right along, we also heard from Sean Klingfeld. I think this is a new responder. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
Ooh.
And he said, the Fantastic Four, two parts blue, one part red, one part orange. Yeah, it's a nice mix. Yeah.
We heard from Big Tim Styles, who said, all the best heroes wear yellow and blue. And then he sent us a picture of the X-Men, Nova, Luke Cage, Booster Gold, Dr. Fate, and I know there's a bit of confusion about the pronunciation. Is it Thanos? I will correct you all now. It is the Noz.
Right. But yeah, that's an interesting call out. That is a lot of blue and gold there. Yeah.
Yeah.
LC Comics at LC_comics said orange and black on Deathstroke. That's a good one.
Yes. Cool. We heard over on Facebook, we heard from Frank Gill, and he said, Wonder Woman, red, white striped boots, blue, lower bikini bottom with white stars, love, 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 love. I think he loves it.
He's a fan. Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah. And still on Facebook, Jared Driscoll said he likes the red and white Iron Man armor color scheme from the mid-80s. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. I wasn't a fan of that one myself, but hey, each of their own.
Okay. We got an email from Rob Kelly, and he said, as per usual, very much enjoyed the first one-third of the show. He only listens to the start because he's not that into the Doom Patrol, and then he comes back for the end, and then I came back for the final third. I need to read more Doom Patrol comics, I guess. In answer to your question, my fave color combo is Aquaman's original orange and green outfit. You're probably thinking that I'm playing favorites just because I like the Sea King so much, but it's actually the opposite. When I was a wee kid and first encountering the Super Friends cartoon, I think it was the fact that Aquaman is coloured so differently than the rest of the team that drew my eye to him. And while Superman, Batman, Robin and Wonder Woman are all using primary colours for their uniforms, Aquaman is all secondary colours, which is very unusual, especially when you consider he has a colour in his name. And while I've enjoyed other looks for the character, like the 1986 camo suit, I still think the original orange and green look is best. Best Rob. Rob also went to the Cubit School. Did you know that, Tamara?
What was his last name?
Rob Kelly. But he's an old bugger, so he's probably there.
Oh, yeah.
Before you.
Okay, Paul, so what's your answer for your favourite colour combo?
Well, it's not very imaginative, but I can't go past Superman. I just the red, the yellow, and the blue. It just says comics to my brain every time I see them.
Okay.
And, you know, I've seen, you know, Superman introduced just by the colours in, you know, there's that transition in Dark Knight Returns where the flag gives way to the Superman symbol, and it's just, you know, you can't see what it is clearly, but the colours just go straight into your head and go, that's Superman. You know what I mean?
True, yeah. Yeah. Very recognisable.
What about you, Mike?
Mine is Delirium from the Sandman comics, which is a bit odd because she can basically be any color she wants, and her sigil is basically a mass of colors and all different objects and shapes. And there was even a storyline where she became a school of multicolored fish because she's Delirium, and why not? And she has different colored eyes, and even her speech changes colors. Again, we mentioned Todd Klein earlier. He did a lot of work where her speech would always be kind of out of shape. All the letters would be mismatched. And then they would also change color depending on her mood and what she was getting excited or angry about. So, yeah, I had to think, look, you come up with some good questions, Paul, damn you. So I had to think long and hard about someone who, to me, really has a lot of colour about them, and Delirium is really it. You know, if you go back and look through some of the old Sandman stuff, she's just always got lots of colour around her, and I really like that about her character. So, yeah,
wow.
Delirium.
You really thought that one through, Mike. Well done.
I had to.
How about you, Tamara? What would you say for color combos yeah, and characters.
I think someone earlier, the more I thought about it, I think like purple and green is one that I like. On the same thing, a couple people mentioned like there's a lot of like triple combos with primary colors, you know, red, blue, yellow, but also with like the secondaries with like green, orange, purple, some combination of that. And I think I like that green and purple. You know, like you got like Joker and the Hulk, like oh, yeah. you mentioned. A lot of other characters that none are coming to mind right now for some reason. or like even like someone mentioned Aquaman as like green and orange, you know, so like two of the secondaries there.
Cool.
Yeah. It's good we don't all work in black and white. All right, and closing out the mailbox, the mailbag, O'Doom, we got an email from Tim Price, and he said, "Hi, Doomsplainers. You said in episode 102 that emails made you smile, and since you guys make me smile listening to the show, it's only fair to return the favor. So here you are." He said that he submitted his iTunes review, and he said it's Dr. Perky 17, but yes, that's me. You can tell by the 17 because that's the price of Tim. I love that bit. And you may remember that you've already sent me one of the lovely postcards when I offered some burned Doom Patrol issues to Paul, which he didn't need thanks to the White Knight, Doug Zavisha. So I was glad to write a review for your show. Thanks, Tim. Thank you
so much.
Thanks,
Tim.
But he's a recent listener. This is what he said. So as a very recent listener, as in I just since JL May's 2017, have you reviewed any of Giffen's Volume 5 Doom Patrol? I'm a big Giffen fan and adored that run. I also did collect the entire Volume 2 run. So that's been a delight to relive. And thank you both for this podcast. Here's to reaching EP 200. We haven't really touched on Doom Patrol Volume 5 yet. We kind of want to get through Volume 2, I think, before we'll start slipping that into the mix.
Mm.
Is that right, Mike? Is that
what we're thinking? Yeah, we've got a bit more of Volume 2 to get through yet. And then, of course, there's always the John Byrne run, you know.
The John Byrne run, yes.
We should do them kind of chronologically.
Well, we like to mix it up, but I think there'll be a way to intermix Volume 4 and 5 in our between new releases of the Young Animal series.
Sure.
So, yeah, we'll get to it. We'll get to it.
Maybe I'm
though
guessing
we did cover, I think, the first the showcase issue, which had DC Presents issue 94, I think, or whatever it was, where Ambush Bug was first introduced by Keith Giffen with Paul Kupperberg. We did that one. So a bit of Giffen there. A
little bit, yeah. But we'll get there. We'll get there. Plenty right. more Doom Patrol to come.
Okay, so I think that's it for our show. Thank you, Tamara, for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, and you dropped some knowledge on about colouring for this. It's made it a very special release of a new issue this week. What books can people see your work on at the moment?
Doom Patrol, of course. There's Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, Wayward at Image, Uncanny Avengers, also I'm doing at Marvel, and been doing a bunch of random things, so I'm not actually sure what's coming out right now. I did a Orc Dave one shot for Rat Queens. It's coming out next month, I think.
Oh, cool.
Maybe
cool.
later. So I'll be around. I'll be doing things.
Excellent.
Fantastic. Anyway, next week on the show, we're going to be looking at more Volume 2 by Rachel Pollack, so Doom Patrol 76 and 77. And our question of the week is, who is someone that no longer works in comics that you would love to see return?
Ooh.
I'll have to think of an answer to that. Why did I make such a hard question?
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
Anyway, as always, if you'd like to get in touch, Twitter, WFDpod, email, waitingfordoom@gmail.com, and there's the Facebook page. And, of course, look out for Doug's posts on mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com. They are in colour, so check them out. So I think that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Tamara.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks so much, Tamara. It's been great chatting with you. And, thanks, everyone. We'll catch you all again next time for more Waiting for Doom.
Waiting for Doom. you know, it's going to be all my energy to not say, so Casey's into pussy.
Oh, God. Oh, jeez. Good thing I'm recording. There's our outtake.